Thank you very much. This is my fourth Philadelphia Society meeting. It's been a few years. I attended it several times in graduate school. I haven't spoken before, so very glad to be back. Thanks for having me, and thanks for that warm introduction as well. So the panel title is The Conservative Search for Identity. The elaboration of the post-war conservative movement was in significant measure framed in response to Louis Hartz's arguments, first made in the American Political Science Review and the Western Political Quarterly in 1952, that America is best understood as a liberal society in consequence of two factors, quote, the absence of feudalism and the presence of the liberal idea. This assertion amounted to a challenge to those who, as we would now say, identified as conservatives. If Hartz was correct, then the United States could not be the natural home of elements of conservatism, whatever conservatism is. Either something called American conservatism would have to be distinguished from the European right of Joseph de Maistre and Louis de Bonald, or to Hartz would go the laurel's crown. Now, Hartz's own articulation of American liberalism was more qualified than the impressions that have come down to us. There has never been, he wrote in this book, in his the book that grew out of those articles, there has never been a liberal movement or a real liberal party in America. We have only had the American way of life, a nationalist articulation of Locke, which usually does not know that Locke himself is involved. And he continued, we didn't even get that until after the Civil War, when the Whigs of the nation, deserting the Hamiltonian tradition, saw the capital that could be made out of it. Ironically, he said, liberalism is a stranger in the land of its greatest realization and fulfillment. Hartz was more than capable, then, of identifying what he called aspects of our original life in the Puritan colonies and the South, which hardly fit its meaning, i.e. of liberalism in the classical sense. Hartz's point was that the United States could be understood as flight from original conditions that prevailed in Europe. His point was, therefore, about the likely direction of the United States rather than about the univocal character of its liberal tradition. Let us then fast forward in one respect and then back up in a few minutes in another. First, the fast forward. The publication of Patrick Deneen's Why Liberalism Failed, although it was the culmination of a long series of debates about liberalism among conservatives, was significant because it was a throwing down of the gauntlet within conservatism. The fusionist project of combining libertarian anti-statism with traditionalist moral conservatism had been finally dashed upon the rocks of popular discontent on November 8, 2016. At that point, fusionism had already been 25 years a zombie ideology, sustained by the misinterpretation of the fall of communism as the victory of Western capitalism rather than correctly as the internal collapse of its opposition. Today, fusionism is a pseudo-aristocratic ideology in that it lives off the financial largesse of fusionists of old, disconnected from any significant constituency in the American public. It is a roof without foundations, the very definition of an economically self-justifying ideology. Why liberalism failed is thus a convenient point at which American conservatives are, uncomfortable as it is for them, being forced to choose between something called liberalism and, well, here is where many have a complaint about the apparent lack of an alternative, since the so-called Benedict option is not a political, but rather an anti-political proposal. Thus far, the most common conservative response to why liberalism failed has been for conservatives to protest loudly the validity of their liberal credentials. Indeed, protestation against the illiberalism of self-described liberals has become the bread and butter of certain sectors of conservative media. It's not conservatives whose liberalism has failed, they say. Rather, liberals have ceased to be, quote, truly liberal. At National Review, my friend Richard Reinsch responded to Deneen's book with a review titled, In Defense of Full-Spectrum Liberalism. National Review's writers now openly take the Hartzian position that the essence of American conservatism is classical liberalism, and therefore that quote-unquote conservatives have to close ranks against non-liberal thought on the right of whatever variety, whether vaguely post-liberal or specifically, say, integralist. Even Modern Age, subtitled A Conservative Review, gives its summer 2018 issue the title, Two Cheers for Liberalism. When conservatives switched to calling themselves full-spectrum liberals, I think a decisive shift has occurred from the way that conservatives of Kirk's generation sought to distinguish themselves from liberals. Conservatives must now side either with or against liberalism. There is no longer a liberal party requiring or wanting their advice and assistance as conservatives. In part, this move results from the way that conservatives positioned themselves relative to liberalism in the development of post-war conservatism after Hartz. Some conservatives simply contested the univocal description of America as a liberal society. Many, however, sought to position conservatism as that form of American political thinking which provided the necessary underpinnings for a functioning liberal society. As Harvey Mansfield, surely our greatest living political philosopher, put it in a 1993 interview, one could define the main task of conservatism today as trying to make liberalism live up to its own principles, in economics to the market and private property, in culture to the high standards of our universities, in constitutional law to the rights of the Constitution and the institutions it established, end quote. Still, he wrote those words as an outsider to the liberal tradition and characterized himself as a friend of liberalism rather than, as conservatives are now doing, a liberal simpliciter. But the reflex for conservatives to defend something called liberalism always, of course, rests on ambiguity about what that liberalism is. And I've conspicuously avoided offering a definition thus far, as I have been remarking, so to speak, only on the current interplay among various political labels. So now we're going to go to the back up. Having finished fast-forwarding from Louis Hartz to Dineen, we're now going to back up to the origins of the liberal tradition. So if we're willing to accept for the sake of argument an otherwise arguably ahistoric attribution of liberalism to Hobbes and Locke on the basis of the role of rights in their political accounts, what is evident, I think, is that liberalism is not, as Hartz suggests, a type of society, liberal society, but rather, at least initially, a sort of political explanation, and in two respects. If we want to make Hobbes and especially Locke the founders of the liberal tradition, due to their emphasis on natural rights and the state of nature explanation, then liberalism is a justification of two things. First, the power of the state, and second, the separation of state and civil society. In regard to the former, all the elements of political power, state capacity, law courts, judicial procedure, etc., already existed before the new political philosophy which explained them. But the new political philosophy gave an explanation which in turn justified them and shaped how they were used. The separation of civil society and the state, by contrast, is often thought to be the key liberal distinction, and it is, but not to the exclusion of liberal justifications for political authority. It is fair, I think, to playfully at least take a Marxist view of the utility of this distinction between civil society and the state. The separation of state and civil society was for the sake of those whom Locke called the industrious and rational, who were to benefit, unlike the quarrelsome and contentious, from the new society that would reward their labors. Thus, in the end, and as liberals readily admit, liberalism did shape a particular character, in spite of its protestations against this fact, namely, the sort of person who could take advantage of a liberal world. Speaking of liberalism in this way allows us to make three initial but certainly limited points. First, I think we have to disaggregate liberalism as a political doctrine from particular political institutions that we explain on a liberal basis. Conservatives writing against the new anti-liberals, for example, frequently seem to think that anti-liberalism simply means something like arbitrary government, and that liberalism refers to basic constitutional protections from the common law tradition, like the right to a speedy trial, the right to confront accusers, proper civil and criminal procedure, and the like. But these are not inherently liberal institutions, although they are institutions that have undergone modification and expansion in the presence of liberalism. Second point in this series, there's also the Anglo-American conservative tradition that Yoram Hazony and Ophir Haivri have traced from Fortescue through Selden as well, as in the United States, Hamilton, Joseph Story, and others. But American conservatives who are closing the gate against anti-liberals have by and large not been flocking to the cause of John Selden or even Hamilton, the ablest spokesman for the Hamiltonian tradition, particularly in regard to industrial development, is Michael Lind, who foresaw the present travails of conservatism in the 90s. Third, we have to acknowledge even the emphasis of the liberal tradition itself on the state, because the American conservative defense of liberalism has emphasized the conditions of liberalism or the traditional elements of Western civilization that have enabled liberalism to flourish. Conservatives have neglected the state. This could not be said of the founding conservatives like Hamilton. Speaking as Publius of the authorities essential to the care of the common defense, Hamilton in Federalist number 23 says, "These powers ought to exist without limitation." When is the last time that American conservatives have used such language? If they are to retain their name, conservatives will have to face the fact that liberals don't want their assistance now and basically didn't want it in the first place. Only an ideology in crisis looks for assistance. Liberalism is not in crisis. It, in fact, triumphed in a far more self-conscious way than conservatives expected. It triumphed by becoming progressive, that is, by becoming aware of itself as a force for shaping American society. Contrary to the typical conservative view, this was not an aberration, but correct. Through progressivism, liberalism, in a way, became more Aristotelian about the purpose of the state. Instead, liberalism is in a long-term decline, a long-term decline of its usefulness as a set of explanatory principles. Virtually no liberals accept textbook Lockeanism. Again, that's outside of the thinkeries. On the one hand, and steadily fewer people among the people would feel their consciences pricked if elements of the common good were to be achieved at the expense of limited government. Liberalism faces a long-term decline of its explanatory value. There is no crisis of liberalism. Rather, the only crisis is within the hearts of elite liberals faced with increasing sectors of the people who don't care for them. Liberals always sensed, to the consternation of conservatives, that the bases on which conservatives offered to help sustain liberalism through an appreciation of order, religion, prescription, etc., were never really intended to be part of end-game liberalism. In now positioning themselves as the last-ditch defenders of liberalism, conservatives are wasting their time defending politically irrelevant propositions with strictures on state actions that liberals long ago abandoned and with insufficient attention to the importance of state capacity in the modern economy. The nobility which is supposed to attach to conservatism is no excuse for mistakes in political strategy, still less for a last-ditch effort on behalf of an account of politics, namely liberalism, which is, in the end, opposed to nobility. On both the liberal or progressive and on the anti-liberal side, politics in Western countries can increasingly be understood through the role of the nations, through the role of nation-state-based welfarist policies. I don't mean the welfare state per se, but procedurally, a conscious attempt to secure elements of the common good, including economic ones. While it is true that welfareism is a far cry from robust, anti-liberal, common good-oriented political views such as integralism, it is a step in the right direction. Ordinary people want the common good and understand that in terms of national integrity and benefits enjoyed in common, whether monetary or religious. It may, in fact, be that in this world, the term conservative has become so laden with its recent mission that it is at least better for conservatives not to think about the question, what should conservatives do, but instead about purely practical questions, such as how can the integrity of the nation state be assured? How can commercial activity and industrial development continue to be turned toward the common good and toward our own strategic advantage? What can we do with the reins of power, that is, the state, to ensure the common good of our citizens, especially since, for the moment, we control three branches of said government? Questions such as these are not anti-liberal. That would be overloading them. They're simply questions that one begins to ask when one's political thinking isn't distorted by liberalism. It may thus be possible to achieve a wider level of agreement than one might expect on what you might call first-wave integralism, that is, on the role of politics and the state in orienting human beings toward the common good. It's not a terribly frightening proposition for students of Aristotle. If liberals, as conservatives say, aren't truly liberal anymore, then it may be easier for non-liberal conservatives to find something to agree about with them. For example, certain elements of protectionist trade policy or even labor-oriented rationales for immigration restriction. Every political view or program of action involves some sort of compromise, but the parties around which the fusionist compromise was built, and it was never, I think, seriously intended to be an intellectual position, no longer exist as political forces. So attempting to solve an intellectual tension between two historic branches of conservatism, the morally traditionalist and the free market capitalist one, is not a pressing political goal. Instead, conservatives should think of themselves as writers in the mirror of Prince's tradition. On the politically active left and the politically rising right, the state occupies a much greater role than it has heretofore in post-war and modern conservative thought. For conservatives, this may mean such things as learning to advise on the use of the administrative state rather than merely making plaintive and nostalgic calls for its abolition. Or it may mean, as we saw in Trump's excellent speech in Poland in summer 2017, giving greater aid and comfort to assertive but still politically responsible nation-state-oriented forces in Europe. Politics operates at and changes at the margins. When conservatives position themselves as friends of non-liberal political thought, which I think they should, it doesn't mean, as David Frum put it in the March 2017 Atlantic, quote, how to build an autocracy. It means thinking and acting politically to defend the current existing vehicle for political action in our interests, namely the nation state. That means defending the nation and using the state. That can partly be explained by, but does not depend upon, liberalism.